to welcome everybody to class today. I'd like to welcome those of you that are joining us right now on our live stream. Appreciate you tuning in, or if you're watching this after the fact, again, we appreciate you being a part of the listening audience. For those of you that are in-house, you should have a set of notes in front of you for Lesson 243, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, Kilburn's Dangerous Errors. For those of you that are following along online and would like to grab the notes, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down under Recent Sermons and click on the link for November 3, and you can access the notes right here that we will be following along with on the screen. So, again, Lesson 243, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, and we're going to continue looking this morning at Kilburn's Dangerous Errors. Okay, let's get right into the introduction, as again, we got a lot of ground to cover in this lesson. So, introduction. In Lesson 242, we began looking at William Kilburn's famous tract from circa 1660 titled Dangerous Errors in Several late Printed Bibles to the Great Scandal and Corruption of Sound and True Religion. In this piece, Kilburn chronicles roughly 10 printings of the AV between 1631 and 1657, containing gross errors of the press. In doing so, we follow the chronological order presented by Dr. David Norton in Appendix 6, Kilburn's List of Errors of a Textual History of the King James Bible. The reason I did that is because Kilburn himself is a little bit harder to follow his order, because it's, you know, sometimes the language is a little bit confusing, and so I just elected to set things up in the chronological order as presented in Norton's appendix, okay? Just as a way to more easily go through the material. So having looked at seven of these printings, so of the ten that Kilburn notes between 1631 and 1657 in Dangerous Errors, we looked at about seven of them in the previous lesson, all right? We will now consider the final three in Kilburn's list, as well as his closing arguments slash requests, and where possible, we will insert screenshots of the different readings noted by Kilburn. So we are able to grab screenshots of a couple of them, not all of them, okay? So let's get then into our main point, which is really a continuation from last week, and that is Kilburn's Dangerous Errors, and we're picking up the chronological order in 1656, an edition printed by Hills and Field. It was printed at London, and it is a duodecimo edition in size, and it is believed, though not confirmed, that this is Herbert's catalog number H660. Okay, so let's get into... Now, this is a little bit of a long entry. So if you look at my point here, this edition, the one we just mentioned there from 1656, Hills and Field, constitutes one of Kilburn's most lengthy discussions. Now, this is distorting because I'm connected wirelessly, so there we go, okay? So this is one of his longer discussions of the ten that he discusses. This one is one of the more lengthy ones, all right? So let's just try to at least get a sense of what it is that he has to say about this particular printing. In a Bible in 12, that's duodecimo volume, printed at London by Hen Hills and I Field, that's John Field, that would be a J, in anno 1656, corrected by Mr. Robinson, a Scottish rabbi, and published in an advertisement in, now help me out with this pronunciation, Mercurius Politicus, right? 6 November 1656, okay? So let's make sure we understand what's going on. So Hills and Field published this volume in 1656, okay? Subsequent to that, or around the same time, there's an advertisement that is published in a document, in a periodical, Mercurius Politicus, and it's dated the 6 November 1656, to be incomparable. So in other words, they are saying in this advertisement that this particular printing is like the superior printing. It's incomparable, right? And they're going to make some specific arguments, okay, for how they come about this. And in truth, I think he was not deceived, though indeed he abused the commonwealth, for I am confident if the number of the impressions was, as I am informed, 20,000, There are as many faults therein, verbal, literal, and in the difference of the italic words to the great corruption of the text. So he's saying that he's heard there were 20,000 of these printed, right? And then he says that he thinks there are about the same number of what? Mistakes and errors, all right? And what kind of errors is he talking about? Faults therein, verbal, literal, and in the difference of the italic words to the great corruption of the text, and in false points of distinction, so that besides the base paper, so what's he saying there? Cheap paper. He's saying it's an inferior edition, and printing, and abridgment, and perversion of the contents, and transposing and confounding of words, whereby it is very troublesome to be read, it is the worst of all the rest that are exposed to your view. So Kilburn is saying that of all the ones he's looked at, this one is what? The worst, okay? Now, let me see here how quickly, I should have had this opened already, and I intended to do that, but let me see how quickly I can find the advertisement, because I do have a copy of it in my Dropbox folder. So, just bear with me for 1 second, see if I can find it relatively quickly. While I'm looking for this, those of you who are on Facebook, I made a post yesterday about our ever-growing collection that Alex and I are assembling in a Dropbox file. How do you spell that, that name of that periodical again?
Mercurius, M-E-R.
M-E-R?
M-E-R-C-U-R-I-U-S.
Okay.
Olympus.
Here it is. Nope, wrong one. This one is what I want. Open Sesame. All right, here we go. Boom. All right. So this is an actual copy of it. Here's the periodical. You can see the date here. So this is from Wednesday, October 29th to Thursday, November 6th, 1656. Here's the title page, okay? And the advertisement is found all the way at the end of this particular edition. See down here, it says an advertisement. So this is what Kilburn's talking about when he's talking about this edition, okay? Now, the reason why this is significant is notice the claim in this advertisement regarding, so this advertisement is talking about the edition we're talking about right now in Kilburn from 1656 from Hills and Field. And notice what they claim in the advertisement, okay? It being examined, corrected, and amended according to the original manuscript copy of the what? Translators. So are these guys claiming in this advertisement that they have the original manuscript copy of the translators and they have examined, corrected, and compared and corrected the text based on this? Okay? Now what's Kilburn saying? He's saying this is what? He's saying, okay, sure. He's saying this is the worst one he's seen. Of all the ones that he's looked at, he's saying this is the worst one. Yet in the advertisement, are they claiming to have amended it based upon the original manuscript copy of the translators? Okay? So let's go back to Kilburn. we talked about the base paper, right, and printing and abridgment and perversion of the contents and transposing and confounding of words, whereby it is very troublesome to read. It is the worst of all the rest that are exposed to your view. As appeared palpably to Parliament, whereby the sale thereof, and there's a word I'm not sure of there, was inhibited, but since dispersed very much at county fairs and markets by bookbinders and petty chapmen, being no fitting book for sale by stationers in London, wherein ye may observe these faults. Okay? So is he saying, number one, this has inferior paper? Inferior printing. He's saying everything about it is what? Inferior. He's saying that it wasn't able to be, so any bookseller that was selling based under the banner of the stationer's company in London wouldn't sell it, but was it sold very widely at, he calls what, county fairs and markets. So So in other words, are there many of these out there according to what Kilburn is saying? Okay? And then he's going to give a list of faults. Now, this could get a little bit tedious to read all of this, so I'm a little hesitant to read all this because it's just going to be kind of the same thing. But if you look at the paragraph at the bottom of page one, so if you're following along online, this is where we are right here. Genesis 1:21. Okay? So he lists out a bunch of stuff. So let's just look at the first one. We'll just look at a couple. Notice, cod for who?
God.
Is that obviously a typo?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think they're calling God a fish. But it's a typo, right? And then he says, notice what he says about that, in so many places. And then he lists a bunch of them, okay? Then notice the next one, and the first one on the next line. Abraham, before God changed his name from what?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, this particular printing, is it calling Abraham, Abraham, before God changed his name, when the text should read what?
Abram.
Okay? So you can get a sense of some of these. In the contents, if you go to the second line from the bottom at the right, he's got errors in the contents kept for left. He's got at the end of that line, at the very end of page one, delivered for divorced at the top of page two. So he's clearly listing out here a ton of different faults and errors in this particular edition. Let me see here. He talks about halfway through the next paragraph in chapter, I'm sorry, on page 2. Notice what he says here. He's got this, this is the one I wanted to talk about. How many times have we talked about Job 4:6? A lot. It's been sort of a talking point, right, as an example of different things. Notice what he says right here about Job 4:6. He says, "Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, the uprightness of thy ways, and thy hope? For is not thy fear, thy confidence, and the uprightness of thy ways, thy hope?" So, is it significantly sort of misordered? Okay? And notice that he says, "Is not thy fear thy confidence?" Oh, this is too funny to me. Notice that when he's identifying what he thinks is the correct reading, it doesn't have the word "this" in it. Which is interesting given the controversy with Georgia and Virginia. For those of you who don't know what I mean, I'm talking about two people who have been very critical of certain things that I've said. Okay? So, it's interesting that when Kilburn gives it, he's saying that the correct reading is the reading without the word what?
This.
Okay? So, notice what else he says there. And notice that he has, and thy hope, and notice he has thy hope still at the end. Not relocated to the middle of the verse. So everybody go to Job 4:6. So what's interesting about this is Kilburn is obviously taking what would have been the one of the 1629 Cambridge readings as what the reading should be, which again is just an interesting point given certain things that have been said. But look at Job 4:6 in your Bible. Is not this in italics, thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and the uprightness of thy ways? Now look at what Kilburn has there. Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, the uprightness of thy ways, and thy hope, which he says is wrong, for is not this thy fear, thy confidence, and the uprightness of thy ways, thy hope? So what he says should be the correct reading is the reading that still has thy hope at the end and doesn't have the word this in it. Okay? Which is just a little bit of an interesting piece of trivia given other things that have been said. So you can work your way down through the rest of this list. Okay, if you look at this line here, he's talking about, let's just get the end of this, okay? It's wholly left out in the prophets, a great number of verbal faults and omissions, which I permit in the evangelists and other many egregious faults, visa. And then he starts listing a bunch of them here in the next paragraph related to the New Testament, okay? Now, let's just see if we can pick up on a couple of these. He talks about nonsense readings here. He talks about errors in title of the law. So he's got one here. Title of the law versus what?
Tittle.
It's supposed to be tittle, but it says title. In John 3:17, for God sent His Son, not His Son, into the world. And notice how Son is spelled S-O-U instead of Son, S-O-N-E, which is the old spelling of Son. He's got loves for loaves. He says there's gross, false, and a dangerous corruption in, I'm assuming this is still John 18, verses 9 and verse 36. There's a, if my kingdom were of this word for world. So it's supposed to say, if my kingdom were of this what? World, this particular one reads word. Look at Acts 2:27. Because thou wilt not leave my owl in hell instead of what?
Soul.
Okay? So if you work your way down through this list, so there are clearly a lot of mistakes that Kilbert is identifying in this particular printing. Okay? So, anybody have any questions about that? What is ironic here, and this is going to come up again later on when we talk about this more directly again, is the fact that this particular printing is claiming in this advertisement to have been examined, corrected, and amended according to the original manuscript copy. Yet it is, on its face, arguably one of the worst printings that Kilburn identifies from this time period. Okay? Now, before we move on, does anybody have any questions or comments? Yeah, it's a great question.
They don't put the source of
who did it. So this is a, to me, this is an example of advertising and marketing in a periodical. So are they trying to give people the impression that that particular printing is the most accurate one they can get because it's been examined, corrected, and amended according to the original manuscripts of the translators? Okay? Any questions about this? Before we go to the next one.
So advertising in 1659 was pretty much the same as it is now.
Yep. That's pretty much a legit takeaway, I would say.
Sale is a sale.
Okay. So look at the next one. 1656. This is a Dutch one. Again, in duodecimal size. That's what the 12 means. Falsely titled Barker and assigns a bill. 1638. And again, this is H 529 through H 535, and Herbert gives further information about this notorious edition its varieties and misprints. So this one has a lot of different stuff going on. It was clearly published. So what? Now notice, don't get confused. Okay. Notice he's got a date here, 1656, right? But the title page, as you'll see in a minute, is going to be dated from what? So he's saying this is a false edition. This is edition printed in the Netherlands with a false title page on it, saying it's coming from London from 1638. Okay, that's what he's saying. Is everybody following that? Okay, don't get confused by the dates there. So we touched upon this edition in lesson 241 when we discussed Michael Spark's 4-page tract from 1641, titled Scintilla, which sheds light on the inflated price of books during the early 1640s. Please note that we have inserted screenshots of the readings and questions cited by Kilburn. So let's look at what he says at the bottom of page 2. Moreover, during the time of the late Parliament, now let me explain that. That would be a reference to Parliament during the reign of Cromwell. During the English Civil War. When he says late Parliament, that's what he's talking about. Okay? Great numbers of Bibles in a large 12 or duodecimal volume were imported from Holland in 1656 with this false title imprinted at London by Rob Barker, anno 1638, wherein Mr. Tiffin and Mr. Hills cannot be excused if reports are true, being contrary to the several Acts of Parliament, 20 September 1649 and 7 January 1652, for the regulating of printing. Okay, now go to top page 3. It's a little small in your notes. I've already showed this image once before, but let's just zoom in on this, okay? So here's what we're talking about. This is claiming to be done by Robert Barker, and it's claiming to be done here in what year? 1638. Now what Kilburn's saying is, this is a false printing originating in the Netherlands in 1656. Right, or 57, did I get it wrong? 56, okay? And he's saying, these guys know it, and they didn't really do anything about it. Is kind of what he's asserting there. Okay, so let's zoom out here. And this is the rest of what he says, so I inserted that picture in there for your benefit. Wherein are so many notorious erratas, right? That's a Latin word for what? Errors. False English, nonsense, and corruptions, that in reading part of Genesis 1, Genesis, I found 30 grand faults, as chapter 27:16, mouth of his neck for smooth of his neck. So I have a screenshot of that. This is from the reading in question. And of course we want to not cooperate. There we go. So everybody grab that verse quick. Grab Genesis 27:16. Okay, so I'm going to read it out of my Bible. And she put the skins of the kids of the goats upon his hands and upon the smooth of his what? So here's the screenshot. And she put the skins of the kids of the goats upon his hands and upon the mouth of his neck. Is that a clear mistake?
Yeah.
That should say smooth of his what?
Yeah.
Neck, but it says mouth of his neck. You're in Genesis, right?
Yes.
Look at chapter 29, verse 13. Chapter 29, verse 13. You go to verse 12. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother and that he was Rachel's son. And she ran and told her father. Now look at verse 13. And it came to pass when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to what? Meet him. Notice. This says what? She ran to what? Meet him. So they have she here instead of what? He. So that's another one that Kilburn is identifying. Go to page 4. Then he gives another one from Genesis. Go to chapter 30. Now we've already looked at these, but we'll just do it again here because we're talking about it in a little slightly different context than we did last time. 30, verse 40. And Jacob did separate the lambs and set the faces of the flocks toward the ring straight, right? And all the brown in the flock of Laban, and he put his own flocks by themselves, and he put them not unto Laban's what?
Cattle.
Okay? He put them not unto Laban's cattle. Now, look at this particular one. Let me make sure we can get it up here. There's a word missing. And put them unto Laban's what? What's missing? The word not's missing from that particular reading. Yeah.
In case it was, I've never heard that word, but it means to be marked with circular stripes or rings.
Okay, thanks. So there's three obvious errors there, okay? Then underneath the picture there, or the screenshot, it says, and in reading Ecclesiasticus, Canticles, and the first 27 chapters of Isaiah, I found almost 100 gross faults, which I did specify to the Parliament, and therefore omit them here. So in other words, has he already identified all of them? Well, he did in something he said to Parliament earlier, but is he going to reiterate all of them here? No, that's what he's saying. He's like, I've already identified them. He said, I did specify to the Parliament, and therefore omit them here. The very importation of the books being an offense contrary to to the said statutes and ought deservedly to be suppressed, which notwithstanding are dispersed in the country as aforesaid. So in other words, again, are these copies being put out into the public readership out in the countryside and places where people are probably buying these, and, you know, they're getting these Bibles, and Kilburn's upset about it because there's all these errors in them of the press. Okay? Any comments there before we move on to the next one?
Two quick questions. Is there any evidence of the purpose behind this, that they were maybe doing this during the Civil War to egg things on or to complicate issues, matters in England, or is this kind of a, hey, let's just try and market this and get it in and make some money?
I think the motivation here is profit. These, in the case of the one that we're talking about right now, it's printed on the continent and brought into the country for the sole purpose of making what? Money, in my opinion. It's an economic motivation. Okay? You might argue that they're trying to take advantage of a chaotic time in England's history where there's civil war going on and maybe people aren't paying as much attention as they should have or otherwise would have had things been more stable. And so they're opportunists. I think you can make that argument. But I think the main motivation for bringing these Bibles in from the continent is to make money. Because there is a big market here that people are trying to take advantage of. Remember, we talked about that before, and we saw that in today's money, we're talking about profits, clearing profits in this market of upwards of $2.4 million in today's money, which we talked about in a previous lesson. Okay? Any other?
Were a lot of people back then illiterate?
I would say, it's a good question. I don't know the exact number. Here's what I do know, that after the Protestant Reformation and the putting of the Bible into the language of the common man, literacy rates did begin to explode. So I would say that as you work your way through the 17th century, more and more people are being able to read. By the time that more people can read by the time you get to mid-century, when Kilburn is writing this, as opposed to in 1611 when the King James first came off the press. I would say literacy rates are definitely higher 50 years later.
Maybe they thought, for all these Hicks campaigners.
I mean, I don't know if that's the calculation, but I would say that the fact that there's such a market and people want to buy them, I would view them as indicating that they can at least be able to read them.
Yeah.
If they're in English.
If they didn't want people to understand it, they still put it printed in Latin,
yeah,
like that common people couldn't.
Yeah. Alright, so any other questions about that one? And I think this is the last one in his piece. 1657, a field printing at Cambridge in octavo, and this is Herbert catalog number 656. Kilburn states the following regarding this edition, quote, in another Minion Bible? That's how I would say that, right?
Yeah.
In eight or octavo volume, printed by John Field at Cambridge, 1657, which feels very much and very dear, at least to
eight shillings,
six denarius per book. So that's what he's saying that's selling for roughly, okay? 8 shillings, 6 denarius per book. And then he gives an example here of a mistake. And I was able to get a screenshot of this because I have access to this edition. Notice he says, Psalm 143 verse 4, therefore is my spirit over, is wholly omitted, and many of them as I have seen. Okay, so everybody go get Psalm 143 in your Bible. And we want verse 4. So notice what the verse should say. Therefore is my spirit what?
Overwhelmed
within me, my heart within me is desolate. Now let's look at the screenshot. There, so this is the bottom of a page. It just says there, and then it says overwhelmed within me. Sorry, it just says whelmed. You're right. There, whelmed within me, what's missing? That whole phrase, the majority of that phrase, so it's got there, But it doesn't even have therefore, it just has what?
There.
Then you come down to the next line, okay? And so the for of therefore is missing, as in, as is, excuse me, is my spirit over. Over is missing from what? The word overwhelmed. So you're missing what? Half a word, one, two, three full words, and another half a word. So four full words are missing from this printing. And you can see that here documented from the screenshot in this particular edition. Okay? And then he ends this and he says, and there are many other faults, as I am well informed, of very great notoriety. And that sort of brings us then to an end of him listing his 10 editions. So before we look at his conclusions, are there any questions?
Which Bible was he comparing us with? He had the perfect one.
Well, I would say he's comparing these against the standard of Cambridge. I think that's clear when you look at, remember that earlier in this lesson we noted the one at Job 4:6?
Mm-hmm.
It's clear to me that he's looking at one of the Cambridge printings as his, if I'm judging just on that example, and I'm judging also by what he says about Cambridge printings, so we can look at that too. Just give me a second here. And we want dangerous errors. See, all this stuff is great when it works right. So, right here. Notice what he says here, Amy. He's talking about a lot of different stuff, and then he says, according to the authentic, corrected Cambridge what? Bible, revised Mandato Regio, which means by the King's mandate, which he can't, I don't think he can prove that, but anyway, by the learned Dr. Ward, Dr. Goad of Headley, Mr. Boyce, Mr. Mead, and printed by the elaborate industry of Thomas Buck Esquire and Mr. Roger Daniel in folio, and he, so he's talking here about which edition. So it's clear when you read Kilburn's Dangerous Errors that he takes the Cambridge printings as what? As the standard that he's judging all of these other things by. Does that make sense? Now what is interesting to me is just a point here. He says the 1638 Cambridge Folio is the one he mentions. In the case of Job 4:6, he's not giving the reading from the 1638 Cambridge as the standard reading. He's actually giving it from the 1629 Cambridge as the standard reading. Okay, so even in this, you have to kind of be like, okay, well, I do think he views Cambridge as the standard. So that part seems clear. Okay, any questions about that?
Were these scholars that are heading these different time periods up? Were these starting off kind of dream team and then sort of fizzling out the third string?
Oh yeah. I can't remember if it was last week or the week before, we looked at that, and one of the complaints by Archbishop Laud is that instead of learned men doing the typesetting and the proofreading, it's a bunch of boys. And when you look at the nature of the mistakes, you know, I'm going to get rid of this. When you look at the nature of the mistakes that we've chronicled here, like stuff like this, obviously the people that are doing the proofreading and the correcting aren't really doing a very good job at all to leave out three words and half of two other words. Okay? Alright, so any other questions? Alright, bottom page 4. Kilburn concludes his dangerous errors as follows. Having thus represented the premises to your ocular demonstration, so in other words, before your what? Own eyes, right? And considering the curse pronounced, Revelation 22, verses 18 and 19, and other texts of Scripture to that purpose, And also that the pious and orthodox ministers do generally complain against the said erroneous Bibles, I submit the whole matter to you, praying God to inflame your hearts with a fervent love of the truth and confirm you in the true faith of Christianity, and that it will graciously please His divine majesty of His infinite goodness and mercy to bless this commonwealth with the like disposition of His blessed word in our own proper dialect and speech, as it is in the original idioms, by zeal and patronage of His Highness and the Parliament. So is Kilburn clearly appealing to the King and to Parliament to fix this and to clean up the Bible printing industry? Now, if I'm reading that wrong, somebody tell me. Is that the understanding you guys are getting? Okay? Next line. And from the private, this is a hard word, emolument. So I do have the, I've looked this up in the OED, it means advantage, benefit, comfort. That's an obsolete word now, okay? However great, how great soever, the scriptures may not be hereafter carelessly and erroneously what? So is he wanting this to be cleaned up? And is he appealing to the Parliament and to the King to make sure it happens? Okay? Whereby to save the charges of good correction and printing, as may be plainly proved by such Bibles which have been printed in late years, or else as is pretended, the prophet will not countervail the charge. So I take that to mean that they need to prioritize accurate printing over making what?
Money.
Profit and money. So I think that speaks to a question you asked me a moment ago, okay? For, as it is credibly reported, Mr. Hills and Mr. Field, now here it is, have several times affirmed that they are engaged to pay £500 per annum, that's £500 for what? Per year, to some whose names out of respect to them I forbear to mention, over and above £100 per annum to Mr. Marchmont Nedham and his wife, out of the profits of the sale of their Bibles, deriding, insulting, and triumphing over others of the king of the printing mystery, right? Out of their confidence in their great friends and purse, as is said, as if they were lawless and free, notwithstanding the truth of the premises and the other grand enormities often committed by them, both from offense and punishment to the great dishonor of the commonwealth in general and damage of many private persons in particular. Now that's a long-winded way of essentially saying what? These guys have gotten away with all this stuff and they haven't been what? Punished for it. That's essentially what I understand them to be saying. It is a little difficult to gather, but if anyone sees it different, I'd be happy to hear your point. So we're all in agreement, generally, that's what his point is. These people of privilege have basically gotten away with murder on printing terrible texts. That's, in a nutshell, what I understand. Mike, do you see it that way or not?
Yeah.
Okay. So, next paragraph. For redress of which inconvenience, and for that I am informed by a gentleman of eminence, that upon his own reading of one of their late printed Bibles, he hath noted and observed above 6,000 faults therein. So, in other words, there's 6,000 what? So these guys, have they been making all this money, particularly Hills and Fields, who he mentions by name, and no one's really done anything about it, according to what Kilburn is arguing here. Now what? Now he gets into a proposal. I humbly propose, out of my unfeigned respect to the public good. So he's saying, he's making his argument appealing to the public good of the people of England that this can't what? That this can't continue. Okay? That the future printing of Bibles may neither be solely appropriated to Mr. Hills and Mr. Field on pretense that of their purchasing the translated copy made in the year 1611. Now, when he references that, what is he talking about? He's talking about this advertisement and the fact that these two guys have claimed that they have examined, corrected, and amended the text based upon the original manuscript copy of who? The translator. So Kilburn is saying, these guys have made this claim, they are printing terrible Bibles, and they should not be allowed to continue to print the text exclusively because they're terrible printers. Now that's the Ross paraphrase, but you get what I'm saying, right? On pretense of their, now see, on pretense of their purchasing the translated copy. So, look at my bracket, referring to a 1656 advertisement claiming to have corrected and amended the AB text according to the original manuscript copy of the translators. And again, that's this line right here in the advertisement. Okay? So is Kilburn taking exception with that? Yeah. And then he says, and unduly entering it lately as their private copy and for their sole propriety in the stationer's register. So we'll talk more about that later. But are they saying and claiming that they have the original manuscript of the translators? Okay? For that is neither rational nor political that the state should be divested of the patronage and protection of the Word of God. So he's saying it is not rational or practical that these private persons should have the sole authority and the crown should not have custodial authority over the text. You following this? Now understand, what has happened in history? Has the crown fallen in disrepair, as it were, during the English Civil War when the Puritans take over the government, right? And so now what's happening when Kilburn writes this is there's a restoration of the monarchy happening after the Civil War, and he's appealing to the crown now that the crown will resume its custodial authority over the text. Because in the crown not having custodial authority over the text during the period of the Civil War, has the text fallen into significant disarray because of all the sloppy printing. Is everybody following what's going on here? Any questions? Okay? So, and unduly entering it lately as their private copy, and their sole, we already got that. For it is neither rational nor political that the state should be divested of the patronage and protection of the Word of God, translated into English, primitively at their charge, and permitted to be printed only cum privilegio regali, which means with king's what? Permission. Now, was that the original situation before the English Civil War? It was. Remember, Cambridge only printed after they were given crown authority to print in 1629. Okay? Being the nation and common evidence of our religion, and like an Elsian? Is that right?
Yep.
Elsian flower of supremacy, and that we should make our defense thereof by and under the private and personal title of Mr. Hills and Mr. Field and their assignees for perpetuity. So in other words, those guys that are claiming this in this advertisement and are then printing all these false editions, they should no longer be allowed to what? To do this. That's essentially what he's saying. Nor secondly, that Bible printing may be left again so loosely and irregularly as of late years it was, and is now in design and project again, to the liberty of any persons free of the stationer's company. So in other words, anyone outside of the company of stationers should not be allowed to what? To print. Now why would that be? Did the company of stationers at least have some standards when it came to printing? Okay? It's kind of like a guild for printers, if you will. Okay? It's not quite what we would identify as a union today, but it's a similar earlier concept of that. It's a control thing for quality and other things, right? Now watch. To the liberty of any persons free of the stationer's company or qualified to print, for that, then a greater mischief will ensue than at present, as common reason will demonstrate. So in other words, if you don't limit this to people who are printing under the authority of the stationer's company, is this mischief with the text going to continue? It's essentially what Gilbert's arguing. But thirdly, that such printers only, as have heretofore discharged themselves with the greatest care and conscience, and for the honor and best acclamation and service of the Commonwealth, either at London or where? Cambridge. So he's saying the best printers of the text have been at London and where? Cambridge. Have also had the full approbation and allowance of Parliament in and for printing of Bibles, and such others as shall be thought meet, not exceeding in the whole some competent number of able master printers, may be hereafter authorized and permitted to print the Bible under the state's privilege only, and not at their own private what? Copy, under such qualifications and provisions for good correction, workmanship, and price, as shall be expedient for the better ordering and accomplishing of such an honorable, laudable, and mighty work and employment. That's a lot. Okay? But it's pretty clear when you read it what Kilburn is arguing. So I've kind of tried to extract sort of a bulleted list of what his main points are here. So let's look at this. In summation, Kilburn, and I should probably get caught up, we're on page 6 if you're following in the notes. Let me just get caught up to this. Okay. So, in summation, Kilburn concludes his piece by making the following arguments. Number one, based upon the evidence furnished in his pamphlet outlining, quote, gross errors in the printings of the AV and warning found in Revelation 22 verses 18 and 19, action needs to be taken to rectify the situation. You with me there? Number two, praise that God would move the King's divine majesty and Parliament to act on behalf of the Commonwealth of England to ensure the printing of the scriptures in their proper dialect, speech, and idiom. Number three, does not want the scriptures to be carelessly and erroneously printed to the private advancement, let's just give the other word, of certain parties. Okay? Number four, Kilburn does not want the future printing of Bibles to be, quote, solely appropriated to Mr. Hills and Mr. Field, appointed by Cromwell, who are trying to assert private right or ownership over the original manuscript work of the King James translators. Number five, the state should not be divested of the patronage and protection of the Word of God. Number six, I think I'm on six, right? The Bible printing should not be left again to those outside of the oversight of the stationer's company. Number seven, only competent master printers should be permitted to print the text under the oversight of Parliament, most notably London and Cambridge. And last, no private printing rights should be allowed in the AV. So I think that's a pretty good list of points of summation out of what Kilburn's final arguments are there. Okay? Now, we still have about 12 minutes to get a conclusion, so I believe we have just a bit of time to pause. Does anybody have any questions? Now, I'm just going to say this, and you guys can respond if you want. Again, as I think about all of this, the reality of what actually happened is so much different and way more interesting than the folklore of what people say and think. Okay? People say and have all these romantic ideas about how this stuff all went down, and I don't mean romantic in the sense of romantic love, I mean in the sense of like nostalgic. And so the reality of it is that it was way more messy, way more sloppy, and got to a state that there were all kinds of problems. And so what Kilburn is doing at the end of the English Civil War, as the monarchy is being restored, he's writing this piece, Dangerous Errors, circa 1660, to appeal to the king and to the parliament to regulate this industry. Okay? Because it got a little bit like the Wild Wild West during the period of the Commonwealth under Cromwell's rule. Bart?
As these corrections became were they corrected by the printers or not?
I would say, and we'll start looking at this more when we kind of build out into other time periods. I would say that for by and large, a lot of the things that Kilburn complained about do sort of get ironed out eventually. And things become more stable after, again, the thing is placed back under the custodial authority of the Crown. Okay? All right, any other comments?
So Mark's point about the correction, I mean, that brings up, like you said, that nostalgia or that romance, even about printer errors that some people will even claim that these are inspired by God too. Well, then why would God inspire a printer error that then he would inspire it to be corrected?
Right. There's a lot of stuff that is said that just doesn't make logical sense, I think is your point, right? So to that point, let's look at the conclusion and see what we think, okay? Conclusion. True printer's errors are easy to spot when compared to the standard received AV text because they are almost always wacky and obvious. In other words, when you leave four words out of a verse, is that pretty obvious that you messed up? When you do some of the things that we've observed just in this lesson, are they pretty obvious? Okay? Look at the next sentence. In contrast, editorial changes are measured, and I should say, let's add the word here, and generally serve to improve the text. In other words, they make it what? They make it better in some way. They smooth something out. They're obviously of a different nature and character than a true printer's error is what I'm saying here. Okay? Most of the textual differences in the printed history of the text are clearly the result of printer errors. Most of them are printer errors. Okay? There are also, however, editorial changes that do not meet the definition of a printer's error. Alright, well, what's the definition of a printer's error? An error introduced into typeset copy by the compositor so that the printer cannot be charged for correcting it. Printing error, a misprint or misspelling in a what? In a text. Top page 7. Compositor, what's that? Is the person who sets the text or type for printing, in contrast to an author's alteration, a correction or change made in a typeset copy that is not a correction of an error introduced by a compositor. So if they take Job 4:6 and they rearrange the word order, that is not the correction of a printer error, that is an editorial what?
Change.
The majority of all of this stuff is printer's errors. The true printer's errors are usually obvious. Thou shalt commit adultery. God is a great rear end, like we saw last week. Okay? Hold off, Bart, okay? I'm just messing with you. Yeah. So, by definition, next point, a printer's error is an error made by the compositor in the setting of the text. This is different from an author's alteration or a later editorial change, i.e. a change made to a text that is not the result of an error introduced by the compositor. The reordering of the words in Job 4:6, see Lesson 237, stands out as a case in point of editorial change, not the correction of a printer's error. See our video also, number 4 of the weight in Numbers 371, printer's error, editorial change is another case in point, number 731, okay? So my last point then is this. Editorial changes and printer's errors are both realities when studying the printed history of the King James text. Studying Kilburn's dangerous errors highlights the reality that printer's errors are generally easy to spot because they so clearly lead to nonsense readings. When a printer's error is not obvious, honest inquiry is open to the possibility that an editorial change has what? Occurred. Okay? So, we still have, that brings us to the end of the notes, we still have a bit of time for a comment or question or two if somebody has one, as we have about 6 minutes. Does anybody have any comments or questions?
We don't know if any of these printers went out of business as a result of Kilburn or the realization of all these errors.
Well, the short answer is no, although this, I get Hills and Field confused a little bit. One of them is going to reinvent himself after the restoration of the monarchy and sort of clean up his reputation from being sort of a sloppy printer to being much more meticulous and accurate as a result. So I would say that Kilburn did have an impact on what happened after the king was after the monarchy was restored in 1660. And that's kind of what we're going to look at next time, is sort of, okay, what happened sort of as a result of all this, and what is the state of the text? What can we conclude then about the state of the text by the restoration in 1660? Okay? So, any other comments or questions?
So back before the Civil War, when Cambridge and London were basically the only guys who had rights to print it, we saw there was errors or differences between those two printing houses, and things had gotten, because of the monopoly, basically, they were getting away with doing some of this stuff, confiscating Bibles, reselling them as their own, even though they were full errors. And then now in the Civil War, it's gotten bad to where anybody's printing it and it's getting errors. So I think it's a good point on Kilburn to point out that he's calling for neither a monopoly nor a free market. So he's calling for more than just Cambridge and London to be allowed to print so that they can correct each other and compete, but not a full free market competition.
Yeah, so his parameters, it seems to me, would be, number one, they have crown authority. Number two, they're within the company of stationers' jurisdiction. And number three, they're, for lack of a better way of putting it, certified master printers. So that could include more people than just London and Cambridge. The only other thing I would add to what you just said is that in 1633, Edinburgh starts printing. And so then they add, Edinburgh seems to be somewhat of a hybrid then between London and Cambridge. And so even when it was just a monopoly, there were some issues. But when the monopoly lapsed, if you will, during the period of civil war, things got much worse. And so the way I take Kilburn is he's trying to call everybody back to attention that something needs to be done about this, and then he does make specific proposals for how he would see that shaking out. So yeah, that's a good point. Anybody else?
On page 5, your references to the £500 per year for some people and £100 for the Needham and his wife. Were those nice ways of saying bribes or payoffs?
I don't understand all the details of why these people are being paid.
That's what I was wondering.
But yes, those are definitely referring to some sort of, you know.
Let's keep it quiet.
Yeah, don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
I did not. I can't see it.
Yes. When and where do you think the folklore began to develop? And I would assume post RV and the onset of the MV mod versions.
Oh, I would definitely say that a lot of the folklore starts to develop concurrent to a lot of modern King James only argumentation. Because even the guy that everyone wants to point to, Reagan, we talked about his piece before. He just relies on Scrivener. He never goes back and looks at any of this stuff. Which is why what Alex and I are doing in my mind is so important, because we're actually collecting the printings so we can actually look at them. So when I include screenshots, I'm including as many screenshots as I can, right? So next week, with Alex's help, since he's listening, I'm going to be able to take some stuff by Norton, show you text, and then insert images into that text of exactly what Norton's talking about, so that you don't just have to take Norton's word for it. So I would think that a lot of that narrative develops as part of King James only talking points. Did he say anything else? Well, anyone else in-house have a comment or a question?
Is this partly why many of the original text purists or, you know, 1611 or die kind of comments, are those primarily then based on following a single person, like what was the first book that you mentioned, where it was basically not referencing outside of anything. It didn't look at the actual scripture. It was just a commentary by one person drawn, I'm assuming, on some sort of evidence, but it seems like the people that I've read will make comments about the scripture itself saying, you know, 1611 or nothing, but it doesn't seem like there's evidence provided, so that's why I'm wondering if they're pulling it from a single source or two sources.
So a lot of that stuff is coming from the talking heads of the King James Only movement from the 60s and 70s, and maybe into the 80s.
But they had access to some of this too.
But they did not have, no.
No.
And this is a point I've been making, right, that a lot of the stuff that was said back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was not said on the basis of actual evidence. People looking at this stuff, it was based on secondhand things and things that were said that, in my opinion, were never accurately vetted.
But they had the access, I guess was my opinion.
No, I would say they didn't. Some of the stuff, some of the primary sources weren't even known by some of those guys at the time that all this started. Okay? And I'll send you a link to that. I've got a video that I did called A Brief History of the King James Only Movement, where I talk about some of that stuff. Okay?
Was that from like 5 years ago?
It's from like 2020 that I taught that lesson. But, alright, we gotta quit though. We're past time and we got to clean up and transition. So appreciate